Trigger warning, this episode contains discussions of guns, suicide, drugs, and substance abuse that some listeners may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome or welcome back to this episode of Crime Cafe Podcast. I'm Amber.
I'm Coral. Happy Memorial Day.
Yes. Hopefully you're not at work.
Yeah, hopefully you're not at work. Hopefully you're having a good time with your family.
Yes.
And spending the day thinking about the reasons for today.
Uh-huh.
And this case, wow. It's a military case.
Yes.
Very appropriate for today. This is about a U.S. Army private second class soldier named Matthew Warren Brown. And our source for this episode is from Vanity Fair. It's from an article called Leave No Soldier Behind, The Unsolved Mystery of the Soldier Who Died in the Watchtower.
Yes, this is...
Right. Incredible mm-hmm. freaking story. It's by William Langweisch, and it came out January 8th, 2019. And under it, it says, is the Army botching its investigations into non-combat deaths? That is, like, a profound question.
Yeah. And I think...
they're a little bit sus. Like, the military's a little bit suspicious.
Yeah, and this article came out in 2019, and I think even more in 2020, we saw more cases come out with the military.
Oh, yeah. Generation Y's covered a lot of military investigations. Crime Junkies covered a bunch of botched military investigations. Mm-hmm. We've covered Chris Brown. It wasn't botched, but, you know, we've covered.
Military. There's a lot, if you just look up, like, suspicious military deaths and things like that.
Especially women.
Yeah. This is a man, but a lot of them are women.
Mm-hmm. So we're just going to get right into the case.
Yes. Do you want me to go first?
Yeah.
Okay. So, our case starts on May 11th, 2008. U.S. Army Private Second Class Matthew Warren Brown died of a single gunshot wound to the head while managing a watchtower at a forward operating base in Afghanistan.
Oh,
and
wow.
He was only 20 years old.
Oh, my God, I know.
And, I mean... really, just like an all-American kid. He was skinny, a bit aimless, but affable and unassuming, it said.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a good guy, honestly, a good person. And at his funeral in Pennsylvania, 200 people showed
up. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
I know. They said he had a very, you could see in his face how good he looked, and he just has a very kind face.
Mm-hmm.
So immediately my first thought is a gunshot to the head. Why did you execute them? You know,
I know.
That's like execution.
Yeah.
In the aftermath of Matthew's death, Army investigators created files about the circumstances. The bullet that killed him was fired from his own weapon, an M4 carbine. And he was working the first shift. It started at 6 a.m. And he was alone in the watchtower by the fortified main gate to the base. That's pretty, like, legit.
Yeah.
The tower was known as the Gun Tower. It was made of concrete and looked medieval when viewed from the outside. It was 3 stories tall. And on the second and third floors, it had openings covered with 2-piece plexiglass windows, some of which had broken off and been lying in shards on the floors. The forward operating base was known as FOB Assadabad. It was a former Soviet stronghold, a grim-looking installation on a shelf above a fast river in the Hindu Kush Mountains, near the border with Pakistan. It had 2 concentric walls. The outer FOB contained a helicopter landing zone, munitions, and fuel depots. Vehicle parking barracks for Afghan army units, and a bazaar where locals were allowed to sell their goods to American station there. That sounds fun. The inner FOB contained living quarters and offices for hundreds of soldiers and civilian contractors, and a small detention center used to hold suspected insurgents before shipping them on for processing elsewhere. Sounds very dramatic. Very governmental.
That would be crazy to be 20 years old and just
in a different country.
Yeah.
Of course he was aimless.
Yeah.
He's like 2 years old.
Yeah, and honestly, like, if you look at his pictures, he just looks like
a baby.
Yeah, and just like a kid that we went to school with, you know? Mm-hmm. He just looks like a good old boy.
Literally.
So, Matthew had been plucked from an artillery unit at a distant fire base and assigned to Asabad. Is that what we
said? Asadabad or?
Asadabad.
I'm sorry, we don't really know.
We're not sure. But it was to work at the detention center.
Ooh.
Yeah. So, like the other low-ranking soldiers there, part of his job was to stand guard in the towers. And it was just like...
boring.
Yeah. Sucked. On the morning in question, staying alert was a problem. So, I assume it probably always...
Yeah.
Yes. It sounds very... boring. Just waiting.
Who wants to be alone at 6 a.m. in a three-story building at the top? Watching nothing.
Yeah. So, soon after the beginning of his shift, the sergeant of the guard, so it was the man that was responsible for the soldiers that were manning the towers and gates, tried to wake up Matthew on the radio. He thought he was asleep.
Yeah.
And it was after the third attempt that Brown did respond intelligibly. So he was asleep. And the sergeant went to the chow hall to assemble breakfast plates for his crew, then drove to the gun tower, arriving around 6:25 a.m. He grabbed a Gatorade and Brown's breakfast and shouted up to the staircase that he was coming, but he didn't get a response.
Oh.
And I feel like he probably, though, just thought he was asleep again.
Yeah, because he was like, wake up.
Yeah.
Like that early in the morning, and now he's there with breakfast, and he's like, yeah. Hello.
But when he got to the top, he found Brown seated on a high bench at an elevated gun table. But he was slumped over, like leaning against the wall in the plexiglass window. At first, you know, he just thought he was sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that he had a bloody nose, which I feel like was probably his first, like, that's odd that he's asleep with a bloody nose.
Right. It's scary.
Yeah. But then, like, this went from, like, he thought he had a nosebleed to, like, this is serious.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then he saw blood and brain matter on the ground. And he set the food and the Gatorade on the table. And then he tapped Brown to see if he could wake him.
His brain's on the ground.
Literally. I don't get that. And then he felt for a pulse. But now he saw the blood and brain matter on the wall and ceiling as well.
No.
But Brown was still alive.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't read this part.
Yeah, he was. He wasn't. What? Yeah, when they found him, he was breathing and making gurgling noises.
His heart.
So, I mean, because it hadn't been that long since they had talked to him.
It couldn't have been.
Yeah. And his weapon was standing on the floor, muzzle up, with a strap loosely around his left leg, and the bullet casing was laying close by.
This just doesn't seem right.
And I don't know why the strap of his gun was, like, around his leg.
Ugh, I don't like that at all.
And it's still standing up,
yeah,
too.
Ooh. The sergeant was not an investigator expected to withhold judgment. He assumed the obvious, that Brown had shot himself. Like, that's what I'm thinking. He radioed to the base office and the medical team, but got no response from either.
But that would make no sense, because if you shot yourself,
I know,
your gun's not going to be standing up.
Right.
Or, and I don't, you couldn't have, if the strap was around your leg, you couldn't get it up.
If it's a big enough gun to have a strap, how did you shoot yourself?
Yeah, I don't know how anybody, like, shoots themselves with a shotgun or, I don't know.
I don't get it.
I'm not familiar with the type of gun that he had, but.
No. I think M4 carbine or something.
Yeah, I don't know what those are, but I'm sure they probably are close to a shotgun.
Yeah. You know,
length and stuff.
Had a strap, so.
Yeah.
So he didn't get a response from the base office or the medical team. What?
Literally, why is that not? The medical team doesn't respond.
That is
That's the first red flag. Where's our medical team? We need to talk to somebody and figure out what's going on there, because.
Yeah, that's like mistake number one that they made with this.
Yeah.
He finally got through to some civilian security. You're welcome.
Literally.
Contractors working for a company called Cobra. He told them there was an emergency in the gun tower and asked them to send help. By now, Brown had stopped breathing, and a man from Cobra soon appeared, felt him for a pulse, and said, yeah, he's dead.
But I wonder if, like, the freaking medical team would have responded if they could have saved him.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, they probably didn't want to, but.
I know. But, like, you can save people in certain situations like that. A few minutes later, a doctor arrived and made the finding formal. Like, they pronounced him dead. The doctor was an Army major named Matthew Mayfield. A medic who accompanied him tilted Brown upright on the bench so his wounds could be examined. Why are they examining it right there?
And why are they touching him?
Stop. Why?
Because
this is why the military gets away, like, they get away with so much, like, botched stuff, because they don't have the same rules as civilian investigations.
No, and everybody's touching him.
Yeah. The entry wound was a hole in his front right temple. It was a, quote, contact wound, meaning the muzzle was right on his skin.
Right up against him.
The exit wound was a larger hole on the back left side of his head. Mayfield laid Brown into an approximation of his original position for photographic purposes. Mm-hmm. Shut your whore mouth. That is so stupid.
Yeah, they moved him and then tried to move him back.
They're like, does anybody remember how he was exactly? Because I don't.
We didn't take pictures or anything.
Yeah. Later, someone else got him upright again and strapped him to the bench to keep him from sliding under the table.
Mm-hmm.
This is somebody's body.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They should be embarrassed.
And it doesn't say in the article, like, the timeline of this exactly, but, like, how long is this taking? Like, get him out of there.
Stop moving him.
Stop. Don't. Mess with him. Leave him alone.
Stop touching him. Don't strap him to a chair to keep him up. Don't move him.
Don't touch him. Just don't touch him.
I know.
He doesn't have a pulse.
Leave the watchtower.
Don't move him.
Call your sergeant.
Call the sergeant. Call the investigators. Don't answer.
Yeah, apparently.
Nobody answers.
Some guy from freaking Cobra is like, hello.
Yeah. This is.
I'm like so upset.
I just can't get over, like, the non-response from the medical team. That kills me.
It's not something that you would expect.
Mm-mm. So, far to the west at the Bagram Air Base, the Army's Criminal Investigative Division, so the CID, promised that they would send investigators. But all kinds of people were just, like, all around the gun tower and, like, around inside, not just outside. They were all inside of it, disturbing the scene, contaminating evidence.
Come one, come all.
Literally.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
That, I mean, and it sounds like, I mean, you've got the man that found him, touching him, then the guy. Then the other guy.
The doctor.
Yeah, repositioned. I mean, there's all these people touching
him. Everyone come take a look.
And I'm sure, like, the gun was probably, like.
They probably flicked that onto the dirt.
Yeah.
They're like, we don't need this.
Yeah, so the sole person there with knowledge of normal procedure in such circumstances was a National Guard lieutenant named Brad Fossest, who in civilian life was a Virginia police officer.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank God that somebody at least.
Someone's like, wait a minute.
And he was trying to get people to leave. Like, you know, he knew, don't touch. But I guess they weren't going to really listen to one person. And he had no authority over the situation. I mean, you know.
Because they have so many different ranks.
Yeah.
Who's going to listen to him?
Exactly. But they should have listened to him.
Yeah.
So he grew so frustrated that he left to interview soldiers nearby. And then by noon, when it came out that the CID investigators had not yet boarded a helicopter.
So they weren't even like on the way yet.
No. And this was at noon and he was found at like 6:25.
Love that.
Well, not he wasn't found at 6:25, but
he was found before 7.
Yeah. I would assume.
So by 5 o'clock, like, or after 5 hours, moving him, strapping him down, they haven't even started on their way yet.
No, they promised to send the investigators, but they didn't. They weren't even on a plane yet.
They're like, I promise this year will come.
Mm-hmm. So they placed Matthew into a rubberized body bag and carried him down the stairs, loaded him into an ambulance, and then he was driven to the coolness of the women's shower room in the inner FOB where he lay at rest, and they placed some guards outside so nobody else could touch him.
Oh my God.
The women's shower room.
I'm gonna cry.
Is where they put this 20-year-old's dead body 5 hours approximately after he was found.
I'm speechless.
So that evening they airlifted his body. What did I say that earlier? How did I say that?
Bagram. Airlifted him. They were like, you know what? Don't even get on the plane to come over. We're coming to you.
I know. And 2 days later, it arrived in a casket at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. So, I don't know what happened in the 2 days.
Right.
You know, it's unknown. And then after a flag-draped offloading was delivered a short drive away to the office of the Armed Forces Medical Examiner.
God.
Yeah. So, that office is the corner for the U.S. military and other federal agencies. And is responsible not only for performing autopsies, but also for carefully considering the evidence presented to it before rendering a solemn finding on the manner of death. So, preferably a choice among natural, accident, homicide, or suicide, and rarely and reluctantly they will do undetermined or like pending.
Mm-hmm.
But they hope to have like a definite like
right
what it was.
Brown's autopsy concluded with the obvious. The cause of death was a gunshot wound to the head. Blood tests showed that Brown had enough of the sedative Valium in his system to render him incapable of coherent action. So if he was falling asleep, I mean, if that's true that he did have Valium in his system.
That's what the autopsy found.
I could see that you would be falling asleep. But that, you know.
But I wonder if he had, like, so much in his system that even when the... Because it sounds like he had so much in his system that even when the guard called him, he wasn't very coherent, probably.
Oh, yeah. As for the manner of death, on May 15, 2008, 4 days after the event, a deputy medical examiner in Dover, Lieutenant Colonel Ladd Tremaine, officially declared Brown's death to be a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
The examiner had little information to go on since the CID investigation in Afghanistan had barely begun.
Just 4 days after.
Yeah, and they were supposed to send somebody. They promised they'd send, you know, the investigators.
But the ruling didn't seem to account for some of the physical evidence. High-resolution photographs of Brown's fully clothed body as it arrived into Dover show no signs of back spatter. Back spatter is a automized blowback of blood from an injury wound caused by a high-velocity round fired at extremely close range. In Brown's case, with an empty wound on the right In Brown's case, with an injury wound on the right side, had the gun been fired, as it was said to have been fired, stock down, muzzle up, between his legs, crime scene experts would expect it to have been present, and it was not. There was no back spatter. So, I don't know what that means, but I get it.
Where was no evidence that it was suicide.
It went through downwards into his right temple and out in the back left side.
So it entered in his temple.
Mm-hmm.
How, if it's between your legs, stock down, muzzle up, between your legs, how are you hitting?
No, that's not right.
You would have to lay your head
onto
the muzzle.
Mm-hmm. The belief that Brown had killed himself was widely shared in Assadabad. I forgot what we called it. Even though not a single soldier who gave a statement after his death was aware of any recent difficulties he may have had. Those who knew him best knew him as a goofy kid. He was quiet. He was relaxed and funny among his peers. And he was recently went home and he was like really... reinvigorated, and he was happy from going home and excited by a promotion that he had just got, and he was looking forward to the successful conclusion of his army service after a few years. His drug use, if they were being honest, was not exceptional. Valium was a way to get through the days. They were surprised that Brown had killed himself. They attributed it to the unknowable in life. And moved on. They were like, he just did, I don't know.
Of course.
And, like, the drug use was not exceptional. I mean, it's pretty easy to get Valium or anything like that in 2008.
He was probably prescribed Valium.
Literally. He probably had, like, a broke toe, and they were like, here.
Brown's mother, her name is Sandra Evans, and she lived in a trailer park with her second husband in Clear Lake, Northern California. She and her son were close, and during his recent leave, they had spent a lighthearted week with friends and family, you know, just enjoying being together, telling stories, catching up,
shooting the shit.
Yeah. And Matthew was very open with her, or he was open with her to a degree.
Right.
That he just, like, couldn't really be with his dad.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming he was probably pretty open with his mom about
stuff.
Yeah. And a lot of, I feel like a lot of men can connect with their mom more than their dad.
Oh, yeah.
So he waited until the very end of his visit to tell her this.
Mm-hmm.
And this is crazy, but okay. So, they were in her car, and they were driving from Clear Lake to the Sacramento airport, and Matthew put on Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen.
I love that song.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody knows that song. Mm-hmm. It's a lot, I mean, it's a good song. So, the song's actually about a man that's, like, crying to his mom.
Yeah.
If you've listened to it, you could...
And talking about the devil coming to get him and stuff.
Yeah. So, he told his mom that he did not want to go back to Afghanistan. And his problem was not with the enemy, but rather with one of his sergeants, who Matthew actually said was a thug.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And he told his mom that the sergeant was running a drug ring. Ooh. And was snuggling. He probably was snuggling some
I can't believe he was smuggling those pills.
But he was smuggling in prescription narcotics from Pakistan and then selling them to the American troops that were eager to tune out the war. Valium. Yep. Bitch. So
he was concerned about his own self.
He had actually let the sergeant talk him in to like being the person that was going to go and pick up the narcotics from Pakistan, which that would be crazy.
I know. Like, of course you would do what he's going to tell you to do. Like,
yeah,
he controls your whole life, your employment, everything.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, wait. He didn't go to Pakistan to acquire the narcotics. He was acquiring them once they were at the little, store.
Yeah.
At the base. Then he would carry the pills past the security into the inner FOB. And recently he had told the sergeant that he wanted out. They're not going to let you just stop.
Yeah.
And, of course, the sergeant had refused and he threatened him. And Sandra Evans drove her son to the airport. He told her that he might not return alive. And 2 weeks later, he was dead.
Oh, God. Please, someone help me.
I know.
When CID agents finally got to her door, more than a month after Brown's death.
Yeah.
Evan says she told them about her son's account of a drug ring at the base, a domineering sergeant, a threat of violence, and his premonition of death. She rejected the medical examiner's finding of suicide, not because she thought it was premature, but because she believed her son had been either killed accidentally or murdered.
Do you think he told his mom the name of the sergeant?
Probably.
I was wondering if...
Well, he said, I'll be dead if I don't come back or you don't hear from me or anything.
Yeah, he told her he might not return alive, but I didn't know if he would have told her the name or not.
Oh, yeah.
Because you know how... Did. Yeah. I just know they can't put that in the article, probably.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Or probably anywhere, really. So, from that day forward, the Army might have considered the possibility that Brown's death was perhaps not a suicide. It could have launched a new investigation. Instead, as the files show, the Army disposed of the case exponentially.
Love that.
Yep.
They're like, maybe it's not, but let's just throw everything out.
Yeah, they didn't follow up or
answer any questions.
Yeah, they didn't really try, it seemed. And Evans received some "We share your sorrow" letters,
right,
and a routine insurance payout, her share of which came to $200,000.
That paid her off.
Yeah. They tried to pay her off.
Yeah.
And Evans didn't know it at the time, but she had company. So, there are hundreds of other non-combat deaths in Iraq and Afghanistan that have been ruled to being a suicide, leaving some families feeling alone, powerless, angry, upset.
Small.
Yeah.
How are you going to fight the military?
Yeah.
It's the military.
The government, yeah. Basically. And also, they were in a foreign country, so...
Mm-hmm.
You don't really know everything that could be going on in their life.
And you don't know anybody. You don't know their daily life. You don't witness anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, much like Evans, these other families wonder whether other factors were at play and whether other causes of death should be considered.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they're probably just ruling a lot of things as suicide because they don't want to find anything corrupt within the military.
Right.
And they don't want to have to get a bunch of people in trouble and they don't want to have anything be questioned or questionable about the military.
No one wants to question something that protects us.
Yeah.
It's just like police and everything like that.
But I feel like more and more people are now realizing that.
You have to.
Yeah. And you have to realize that with anything, when there's a bunch of people, there's going to be stuff.
You have to question. That's
not on the up and up.
Right. And you have to be open for questioning.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just.
Yeah. So, the common denominator in all these is the family's bewilderment. These suicides are just taking place with no warnings. I mean, you know, they had seen him 2 weeks mm-hmm. before, and he
didn't seem depressed.
No, he had just a worried. Good, yeah,
about the
yeah,
guy.
Worried about that, but he had a good visit. Mm-hmm. So, sudden self-destructive acts that could not have been foreseen and are not explained by official findings. The precise numbers are unknown, and some of the suicides have probably actually been suicides, I'm sure.
Right.
It's not, you know, unheard of. But despite what the families think, suicide, not combat, is actually the leading cause of death among U.S. soldiers.
And veterans.
Yeah. Oh, veterans. It's terrible.
You would think it's natural causes, but it's not.
No, and it's disgusting that we let our veterans come home and not have the proper care. It's disgusting.
No jobs. Homeless.
No jobs. Homeless. PTSD. I mean, they have a lot of the trauma that they need.
Chris Connell.
Help through.
You remember the American Sniper?
Mm-mm.
They made a movie about it. One of his fellow veterans shot him. Yeah.
No.
It's a really crazy story.
Oh, so sad. And actually, this is so sad and has bothered me so much, but my aunt had a neighbor, and he was a veteran, and he actually recently killed himself. And it's so sad. And that's, you know, and that's awful that they come home and can't get like therapy or counseling to help them with these things.
So ridiculous.
I know. And then, obviously, like, proving the CID wrong would require access to closely held files and expensive, painstaking research.
Yeah, you're not going to get in there.
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to give you those files ever.
I know. According to this, they don't have them anymore. They threw them out.
Yeah.
So, but
I wonder if there's anything, though, that you could do to get, to, like, make the military give you files.
Like a court order?
Yeah.
Or a subpoena?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure you could.
You think so?
Oh, yeah, because I've heard of, like, there was one case, they wanted to get their daughter's autopsy photos, and they, like, kept putting it off. And finally, they were court ordered to send a disc of them.
Oh, okay. Okay. Most military families lack the resources, obviously, to challenge these official findings. But the numbers we do know suggest that Army investigators are mishandling these non-combat deaths in the war zone, adding to the anguish of the families whose loved ones died while serving their country.
Right.
You would never think that, like, combat wouldn't be the number one cause of death.
I know.
That's insane.
Like,
to me.
You think your son's going to be safe because he just sits alone in a watchtower?
Yeah. That's the. Oh. So, since 2001, the U.S. military appears to have prosecuted only 5 soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq for the murder of fellow soldiers.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was in 2019, but I would say the number probably hasn't went up. Probably Annie, honestly.
Yeah, because in 18 years, they only got 5.
Yeah, so.
That seems likely for sure.
Yeah. And I feel like anytime you just have a bunch of people together all the time.
Yeah.
There's going to be some violence. Yeah. I mean, people can't always get along. And during the same period, it has ruled the deaths of 362 soldiers to be suicide.
How do they just assume?
There's 5 murders and 362 suicides?
Mm-hmm. I know.
That is so insane.
It's not likely.
I know. A recent study in military medicine found that the suicide rate among U.S. civilians, adjusted for age and gender, is roughly comparable to that of soldiers. Yet, among civilians, the suicide rate is only 2.5 times higher than the murder rate. Yeah, that's better. Among soldiers in combat zones, if the military is to be believed, it is roughly 70 times higher.
Mm-hmm. So if you go into the military, no matter if it's in combat, not combat, you have to assume that they're going to say that, like, there's a 70%. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like you're 70 times more likely
to commit suicide than be murdered.
Right. According to what they say.
Yeah. But in civilian world, it's only 2.5 times higher than the murder rate. But there it's 70% higher.
That is insane.
Yeah.
That is so... Do they not realize how stupid they sound?
I know.
Sandra Evans wanted answers. She fired off her first letter to the CID 20 days after her son's death. And never let up from there. Her letter-writing campaign widened to include Senator Barbara Boxer, President Obama, and many others. She did not represent herself well on paper, according to this article. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
But her anguish and skepticism were both real and legitimate. In response to her letters, the Army gave her the brush off. They're like, it is what it is.
Yeah. And I think
so horrible.
I think it was weird, too, that they, like, said that she didn't represent herself well on paper.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't feel like many people in that situation would, because you just wouldn't know what to say.
Yeah. How would you represent yourself?
Yeah.
I want answers for my son.
Yeah.
The CID informed Evans that because the investigation was active, no files could be released. She kept after it anyway, and the investigation eventually morphed into a dead-end inquiry into the sale of narcotics at Assadabad. No charges were ever filed, and the investigation into the death of Matthew Brown was formally closed on February 8th, 2009. Amazing. They washed their hands of him. Perfect. That is so disgusting. Several months later, about a year after her son's death, the case files from the CID started trickling into Evans' mailbox. They consisted largely of investigators' logs, along with sworn statements by soldiers on the scene. They get like 100. I was there.
Oh, no.
All 100 of them. The files appeared to be disorganized and incomplete. They contained omissions, heavy redactions, and maddeningly, a large number of unexplored contradictions. For a few years, Evans and some of her son's fellow soldiers tried to make sense of them. They marked up the original copies and made a mess of them. Eventually, Evans went online and identified a professional, a lawyer named James Culp, who had an Army background and deep experience with military criminal investigations.
How are they just allowed to, like, omit and redact stuff?
Even not the military, just at all.
Yeah, at all. When it's a closed case, why can your family not know everything that the...
What did you say at first?
Yeah.
What was redacted?
Yeah, why is it...
Because that matters.
Yeah, it does.
Okay, Culp is an acquaintance of the writer of this article, who several years ago helped him to deconstruct a war crime in Iraq. When when Sandra first contacted him, he refused to get involved, but she kept with it. And after 16 months, every single week she contacted him, he finally agreed to see her. God, you let her go after you for over a year?
Yeah.
Bro.
Almost a year and a half, she was at this every week contacting this man.
That's so sad.
She wanted answers for her son.
Yeah. She deserves them.
Yeah. So, in 2014, Culp and Sandra met at a hotel near San Jose, California. I always think it's so weird when stuff happens in 2014 because I think, like, I was graduating high school, like, having the best time, and then, like, this awful stuff was happening to other people.
Some people were having bad times.
It makes me so sad.
I know.
So, they had a long conversation that was obviously very intense, and by the end of it, Culp had agreed that he would take on this challenge of going through the case files and getting them sorted out, and that he would do it for free.
Awesome.
That was nice of him. He should, after making her try for 16 months. But he did not know what he was getting into, and it took him more than 2 years to go through all the paperwork and the redactions and just kind of, you know, put it all together.
Right, in order.
Yeah, and what he found, based on more than 24 witness statements that the military had collected, their official 17-page report and a full-scale recreation of the crime scene by independent forensic experts, it raised disturbing questions about the CID's investigation into Matthew Brown's death.
Right. So the lawyer's like, I totally get this.
And he was in the military for a long time. Yeah. So
he knows that this isn't right.
Yeah.
Brown was born September 1st, 1987 in San Diego after Sandra went into labor at a McDonald's. Bless her heart.
Oh, no.
His father was serving in the Navy at the time. Eventually, the couple divorced, but Sandra remained in California, or on the West Coast. Matthew and his younger sister moved in with their father to Zillianople, Pennsylvania, which is a town about half hour north of Pittsburgh. His father became an engineer for the Federal Aviation Administration. Go him.
Yeah.
Matthew was placed in special education programs because he was severely dyslexic. Same. After graduating from high school in 2006, he joined the Army and eventually was posted to an artillery battery at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Love them.
Yes. And they actually have said that Matthew was not a model soldier, but he did perform well in the field, but he just hated the physical training. And he hated the physical training and the discipline.
Right.
And he just lived for the moment. He played video games. And he had no sense for the value of time. He went AWOL.
Sorry, I didn't mean to, like, interrupt you, but he just sounds like a sweet kid. Plays games. He's like, dude, I'm sleepy. I'm tired. I'm bored. Mm-hmm. I don't like discipline. He just sounds like a young kid.
Yeah.
Like, it's so sad that his life was taken.
And I don't know, you know, if he grew up in like a small, it sounds like he grew up in a small town.
Right. He doesn't like the physical part of it.
Yeah.
And he just sounds normal.
Yeah. It makes me think of a lot of people like we went to high school with.
He just sounds very grounded.
Yeah.
He's not overperforming. He's just like, I am what I am. I'm freaking tired.
Yeah. So Matthew had actually went AWOL twice, and both times he had binged on cocaine.
Irrelevant.
Yeah.
Why do they?
I guess they just wanted to.
I know they have to, but.
Yeah. I know it sucks, but. So his first absence, it actually lasted several weeks until he was tired of partying and reported for duty.
That seems insensitive to say.
Yeah, I don't feel like that's the whole... See, I feel like when they go AWOL, you should start, like, trying to maybe get them in some therapy if they come back.
Yeah, like, you should be concerned. Like,
yeah, they have something going on.
If you have a soldier literally hiding from you...
For weeks.
Something is wrong.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's him, anybody else that goes AWOL.
Yeah,
if you
literally.
Have someone running away from the military, you need to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be about discipline. It should be about helping them.
Yeah.
That'd be like if I hid from my job.
I know.
Like, I would hope they would try to help me.
Yeah. And you're there away from your family, so you would really hope that these higher-ups would understand that, like, this is somebody's child. Because mm-hmm. the higher-ups are probably older and have children.
Right.
This is somebody else's child. Take care of them like you would your own.
And they've been the child. They've been the 20-year-old.
Yeah.
Scared.
Yeah.
I mean.
But they probably don't. I mean, it's hard once you get, like, higher, like, you know, when you've worked somewhere for a while or anything, it's hard to remember
yeah.
what it's like when you're first there.
Right.
It really is, but still. And then his second absence took him to a construction job in Pennsylvania and lasted for 3 months.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then local police actually got him and he was shipped back to Fort Bragg. See, like... He left and went and got another job for 3 months.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised they even kept him.
Yeah, I really am too.
Dishonorably discharge him.
Yeah. Well, they didn't do that, but they fined him.
They probably court-martialed the heck out of him.
Yeah.
Like, made him go to...
And they demoted him to buck private. I'm not exactly sure what that is. And then they gave him a choice of getting kicked out or being shipped off to Afghanistan, and he chose Afghanistan. Well, I feel like... Obviously, he, like, wanted to be in this, and his dad was in the Navy, so he's probably, like, trying to follow in his footsteps, so...
Right.
I'm sure... And you don't want to be dishonorably discharged, because no. I'm sure he would have been.
And he wanted to do the right thing. That's why he came back the first time.
Yeah.
Who knows if he was abused or what in the military?
Yeah, you don't know.
You don't know why he ran away
no.
so many times. In December 2007, about 6 months before his death, Matthew, arrived at a large American fire base called Blessing. It stood beside the Peck River among the Hindu Kush Mountains in a heavily contested valley. The role of Blessing's big guns was to pound the mountainsides and provide fire support and defense of smaller outposts of being at risk of being overrun. That's literally gibberish to me.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means. There is no record of Brown ever having expressed an opinion about that mission or the larger purpose of the war. I mean, same.
Where is he? Who would he be telling that to anyway?
I have no clue where they're getting this.
I know. That's weird to even.
He was relatively happy at Blessing, which he considered to be better than Fort Bragg. Obviously, he ran away twice from
yeah,
Fort Bragg.
Yeah, there's something going on there.
Yeah, for sure. But he didn't stay long in Blessing. And in January 2008, he was transferred to a detail at the detention center where he, you know... In Assadabad.
Yeah.
His barracks was partitioned with plywood into 5 individual bunk rooms, plus a common area furnished with a table, sofa, microwave, and TV. All of the residents there worked at the detention center, and those in lower ranks also had gunned tower duties to perform. And we have a picture of the barracks. We have a picture of the barracks and the gun tower. I mean, the watchtower. 2 days before Matt's death, he was promoted to private second class. See, so he's doing better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's thriving. I mean, yeah, he falls asleep, but, like, he's thriving way more than he was at Fort Bragg.
Yeah.
And they even said he liked mm-hmm. it better. He was pleased, and he told a sergeant who promoted him that he hoped to rise to the rank of specialist before leaving the Army. He went to the chaplain... And asked about the requirements to become a chaplain's assistant.
Oh.
Why am I going to cry?
You want to be a preacher?
Yeah, you want to help. Like a deacon?
I don't know what a chaplain in the army does, but a chaplain, like, at the hospital, they just, like, go around and talk to them and pray with the people that are at the hospital.
He must have wanted to be kind of like a deacon or help with, like, missions or whatever they have.
Yeah.
He sounded like he was doing good. For once, he was planning for the future. Oh, why does it say for once? I hate.
Well, he was only 20. What? I mean, he was in the army. That was a plan for the future, really.
Yeah. He borrowed a PS2 from a friend, promising to return it soon.
So that's things you don't do if you're about to kill yourself. You're not going and talking to the chaplain or borrowing things.
Exactly.
So, for the midnight shift, the normal procedure was to place two guards in the gun tower so they could keep each other awake. Mm-hmm. But on the eve of Brown's death, the two guards were friends, Jay Flannery and Aaron
Sionfroco.
Sionfroco. Both were specialists, two ranks higher than Brown. Before going on duty that night, they say that they saw Matthew at the barracks. They knew he liked to sedate himself with Valium, and Flannery thought he seemed out of it, and he yelled at Matthew, who had to take the 6 a.m. shift, that he needed to go to bed.
So he was taking Valium before he went to bed.
But it was midnight.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't midnight, but it was, they saw him that night before they went to work, I guess.
I wonder if he was playing the PS2, taking Valium. And they're like, go to bed, literally.
You have to be here at 6 a.m. to let us go home.
That's my husband.
Not home, but.
Yeah, to go back
to our room.
We want to go to bed.
Yeah. So at 5 a.m., Flannery called someone to wake up Matthew. Brown got up. He got dressed with his right boot unlaced and made his way to the tower.
Same.
So he was out. And a sergeant actually stopped him because he seemed drunk.
No, bro. He's just got a 6 a.m. shift.
And the sergeant checked to see that his weapon was on safe.
Oh, good.
Did he mean, like, the safety was on?
Yeah, so they didn't accidentally fire it.
Yeah. And he got close enough to sniff for alcohol and smelled none. So he wasn't drinking.
But he should have stopped him and got him to a medic or something.
Yeah. So Matthew went ahead and he continued onto the gun tower, and he got there about 5 minutes later. And then from the third floor, the other two guys shouted at him to hurry the fuck up. So I'm sure they're probably like, we're ready to go. Get in here. And then they swore at him again when they passed him on the second floor going down as he was on the way up. He kept his head down and he mumbled something and went past them carrying his M4. He was evidently doped up far more so than he had been the night before. Mm. So, and they declined and didn't respond to comment on when the...
Yeah, the story. Yeah. This article.
When the man from the article reached out to him.
So the two guys... They caught a ride with the sergeant of the guard who happened to be passing by. When they got to the barracks, they dumped their gear and briefly discussed the situation. According to the subsequent sworn statements, they decided to inform their superior, Sergeant First Class Armando Torres, the MP in charge of the detention center. The time was just after 6 a.m.
So they...
were concerned.
He had to be really, like, for someone to think he was drunk and then them to report him.
And you have to be so nice and tidy with your clothing in the military.
Yeah.
You can't just walk out unlaced.
Yeah.
And I find it highly suspicious that they just let him go even though they thought he was drunk.
I know.
I don't believe that.
And I just don't. And, like, why did he take so much Valium? Well, you wouldn't take Valium. Well,
I mean, why would you? He could have taken it, But let's just think for a minute. Why would you take that irresponsibly? Even though you just got a promotion, you know you have to be up. It's the military. This is your second chance.
And I don't feel like if you're wanting to like be the chaplain's assistant, I just really don't feel like you're going to be out here. Even, you know, if they're prescribed to you, I don't feel like you're going to be out here abusing your prescription pills.
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't know. But the next half hour is very crucial to this story. This is when, you know,
everything happens. Yeah.
So the witness statements about events during that short period have numerous contradictions. And the CID investigators actually failed to explore these in their report. They basically just took them and it didn't matter that people were contradicting each other. So having dropped their gear at the barracks, Specialist Flannery and Cianfrocco wound their way to the chow hall. They were there having breakfast with Torres and his deputy, a staff sergeant named Matthew Jackson, when a soldier hurried in around 6:30 and said there was an emergency in the gun tower.
Mm-hmm. So in 25 minutes this happened.
Yeah. So were they just all in there eating and that's why they weren't responding to any of the
calls? How many people were on this literal base? Is there like 5 people on this base?
I know. I don't understand. So.
How does the military work? I don't get it.
I know. So Torres and Jackson immediately left for the tower. They arrived about 3 minutes later. But the other two guys that Matthew had just relieved just stayed behind to finish their meal.
Okay.
But you... I don't understand that.
Hold on.
Okay. When Torres and Jackson got to the gun tower, the third floor was occupied by the doctor and the medic. And although Torres had no training in such affairs, he seemed now to place himself front and center. It's kind of weird when people just...
they don't really, spotlight?
Yeah. He actually asked Jackson to remain on the third floor to make sure that nothing was touched while he went to retrieve a camera and report to their commander. And Brown sat dead on the bench, stiffening and leaking blood from his head.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Stop.
So while Torres was gone, Lieutenant Faust, is that what you're saying?
Faust? Faust? Lieutenant Faust, the cop from Virginia.
Yeah. When Torres was gone, the cop from Virginia showed up and took notes. The statement he later gave the CID was the most complete description provided.
Awesome.
And probably the best, accurate, because he knew what to look for. And it actually included detail that stands out is especially significant. He observed a small hole in a plexiglass window well forward of Brown's body. And of all the witnesses, only Fawcett remembered it. He characterized the hole as fragmented and sketched its location in the window pane. And it was the sort of hole that a 5.56 mm round from an M4 might have made.
So it went through the plexiglass.
But like it was, I don't think he thought that it should have because it was like in front of him.
Yeah.
And if it went in the.
Right.
Yeah. So, the CID never performed a ballistic or targetry study.
Trajectory.
Mm-hmm. What is trajectory?
Like the angles and stuff.
Okay.
And where it was going. Like if it's the angle down.
Yeah. So like where it came. Yeah.
They didn't. Compare bullets. They didn't look at the bullets, like how it was hit. The shell, they didn't look at the shell, nothing.
Because if they would have looked at that, the bullet from him probably wouldn't have made that hole in the other plexiglass window. So, other examinations have suggested that the hole was in a location that was unlikely to have resulted from a self-inflicted shot to the head from the muzzle-up weapon loosely strapped around Brown's left leg.
Of course. Yeah.
And when Taurus returned with the camera,
holy ball sack, I am so sorry. Look at this gun. How are you gonna shoot yourself with that? Bro, that's an assault rifle.
Yeah, and if it's got, I mean, if it's got this clip in it, that would be really hard to, like, have between your legs and the scope and everything.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Let's see. Carbon weight. How much does it weigh? It weighs... it weighs 6.63 pounds, which is a lot more than you think when you're holding it against your head above you. So it's already got weight pushing on you and on your arm.
But they think he had it between his legs.
It fell between his legs, they say. You know what I mean? Because the bullet came through the top of his right temple. So it had to, it was contact with the skin. So it had to.
There was no way that it could fall.
No, it couldn't. There's no way it would fall to his right or something.
I don't know how it would fall perfectly between your legs. That's insane.
When Torres returned with a camera, Faust asked him to recuse himself and withdraw from the scene because of his close ties to the deceased. Standard police procedure. I didn't know that they were close, but Torres stayed, saying that he had volunteered to Major Mayfield to photograph the scene. Faust told the other soldiers who were now milling around the third floor to leave until only he, Torres, and Mayfield remained. Good. After Torres finished photographing the scene, Faust escorted him to the base of the tower, leaving only Mayfield inside. Faust put a soldier on guard and gave orders that no one was to enter the tower until the CID agents arrived. But his orders didn't carry any weight, and they weren't listening to him. Plus, they never arrived, so there's that. Yeah. Torres was not only military policeman at Asadabad, he was not the only one. A group of MPs were helping provide security to reconstruction teams. These were full-fledged policemen with crime scene training, not primarily jailers like Torres. On the morning of Brown's death, all of them had departed on missions except for one, a sergeant. When he heard of the trouble, he grabbed his shoulder holster and ran to the tower. According to the CID report, when he got there, he was stopped by Torres, who told him that his assistance was not required. Since Torres outranked him, he had no choice but to, like, go away. So they could have had help.
What was Torres's rank?
Sergeant. Love that.
There it is.
He's like, you can't help. But they literally have investigative...
Is she asleep?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Your dog... Oh, Amber's dog's, like, having a dream. It's so cute. The company commander, a captain, had ordered Torres to secure Brown's living quarters and to have Flannery and Cianfrocco report to him. They're like, oh man, we just had breakfast. I don't have time for this.
And they had worked a night shift.
Yeah, that's so horrible. They're so dumb. Torres found the two soldiers in the inner FOB and sent them to see the captain. And the captain told him to, like, make a statement. And they just typed it into a standard form on a laptop. And Torres loaded the statements onto a thumb drive. And by this time, it was 9 a.m. And the CID agents still weren't there, as we know. They never came.
Yeah, that's... So, Taurus's movements over the next few hours are unreported, but by 11:30, when medics strap Brown to the bench to keep him from sliding into his own blood on the floor, Taurus was present. Mm-hmm. And a half hour later, when Mayfield had arrived to remove the body, Taurus followed him up to the third floor to assist with the job. Extracting Brown from the bench required that his weapon be removed from his leg. Mayfield took care of it, handed the weapon to Taurus, and instructed him to switch its firing selector from semi to safe.
Why would they do that? Touch it. Why would they touch the gun? Without gloves or...
I don't know.
They're like, come on, boys, yeah. Load up.
And why was it just... They probably should have made sure the safety was on before anybody ever touched it.
Yeah.
And just chilling there. But Taurus actually did more than that. Having rendered the weapon safe, he disappeared with it to the tower's second floor to clear it. But he was wearing rubber gloves. He dropped the magazine, ejected a round from the firing chamber, checked the chamber to verify that it was empty, reloaded the ejected round into the magazine, and clicked the magazine back into place.
God! They're literally invading every part of this investigation.
I know. And then he clicked the magazine back into place. Investigators later questioned why he had taken the weapon to the second floor to clear it. He explained that he wanted to minimize the risk to people on the floor above. So he was like saying that when he was clearing the weapon, he was afraid it was going to go off.
You're afraid you're going to shoot everybody in there with the semi-automatic weapon?
Exactly.
By clearing it?
I know. This.
Sorry, he's a dumbass.
Yeah, and why do they even let him, like, have it and go alone to a different floor with it? This is so weird to me. So, this basically implies that clearing the weapon might cause it to fire. And the investigators didn't challenge that logic. I'm sorry. It's not gonna fire, I mean.
It's not.
You have to pull the trigger.
He took the magazine out. I mean, what's it going to fire?
Well, there's still one in the chamber.
Oh, well, yeah, but...
But he took that out,
too. He took that out, yeah.
And put it back in the magazine.
And it was on safe, which you still should be careful, but...
Yeah, obviously. And, well, to clear a gun, what, just point it down. Point it toward the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, you know. So, Torres returned Brown's M4 to the third floor. But 3 months later, this was long after his death had been ruled a suicide, an Army forensic laboratory in Georgia found no fingerprints on the weapon.
There should be.
Yep. But it was impossible to know that if anyone had wiped the rifle down. I mean, and if anybody did, it wasn't...
Mm-hmm.
Put anywhere, and nobody's gonna confess, obviously.
Right.
And it was not tested for DNA. And it was also found that Matthew's hands didn't have gunpowder residue on them.
They should.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. I don't.
That gun would absolutely annihilate somebody if it was put to their head.
Well. Yeah, why was it not tested before? So, according to Jackson's sworn statement, he and Torres had lunch. Then, contrary to common sense and crime scene norms, they returned to the gun tower and spent 15 minutes inside alone. Jackson said they looked for the bullet and ricochet marks. He did not say why.
Yeah, they just want to make sure it looks like a suicide.
Yeah, literally. So, to any competent investigator, this statement alone should have been setting off alarms because there's just no need that these two men needed to go in there alone and be looking for this.
Nobody needs these two random men up there.
Yeah, and Torres never even mentioned this in this visit, but they had... Taurus and Jackson both declined to talk to the man that wrote the article also.
Of course.
Yeah, nobody's going to come out and talk about this.
The CID agents arrived around 2 p.m. on the day of Matt's death. After he had already left.
So yeah, so that's
been
like
gone
2 hours. Yeah.
There were two of them. Their names have been blacked out in the files.
Why?
See, yeah, why? Why can't you know that? Who was investigating your son's death?
Oh, no. Torres was the first person with direct involvement that they spoke to. He informed them that he already, like, came to the conclusion that he was, like, Matt shot himself.
No.
He said that he had taken pictures and that his body had been removed and that his weapon had been cleared and the crime scene had been disturbed by medical personnel. He also said, incorrectly, that he was the only MP currently on the base, but that wasn't true. Because remember, the guy, a bunch of guys left their duties help. And he was like, no, I got it. The agents got to the gun tower at 2:45, and for the next 2 hours and 45 minutes, they performed a detailed examination of the third floor, including, you know, mapping the locations of the blood and taking measurements of the gun table, the chair, and the window. But they didn't do ballistics. Cool. Nothing in that room was supposed to escape their attention. They were unable to find the bullet or fragments of it. Even when they returned the following morning with a metal detector.
What?
Okay, Torres, we see you. Literally. You took it.
Yeah, somebody did.
In retrospect, on some of the simplest matters involved in detailing a crime scene, they made fundamental errors. They got the dimensions of the gun table wrong. Okay.
What?
This was an important miscalculation because it allowed for subsequent miscalculations to stand.
Well, yeah, because if he's sitting there, like...
Especially if a trial was to occur.
Yeah.
They need the correct measurements to prove that it couldn't have been a suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Furthermore, when the agents came to the hole in the plexiglass window that Lieutenant Faust clearly described as fragmented, one of them wrote, quote, based upon the point of impact, possible trajectory of the projectile, the size of the hole in the plexiglass, and the lack of cracks or stress marks around the hole, it did not appear as though the hole was made by a small arms round. So they were like, it wasn't that. I don't know how they would know that when they haven't even done ballistics. That was it. They never returned to the subject, even after Faust, their fellow policeman, submitted his observations. 10 years later, under pressure from James Culp, the lawyer, CID produced photographs from the files that clearly showed a fractured and splintered hole in the plexiglass. Liar pants on fire. They said it wasn't. After inspecting the tower, the agents went to Brown's quarters, a scene that had been secured by Torres. There in a plastic bag, they found 12 empty blister packs, which, if you don't know, are like pills. You can poke them out of the pack, like Tylenol.
Yeah.
Not you, but the listeners.
Oh.
Amber's like, hey, I'm a CNA. Each of which they had contained 10 milligram pills of Valium. The discovery was significant. This was a high-quality industrial product. Industrial? That was coming across... they need Valium for robots. That was coming across the nearby border, and it suggested access to more than artisanal level of Pakistan narcotics. They're like, this is that good-ish. Three more blister packs appeared during a second search. He had 15 blister packs, empty blister packs.
What? Of 10 milligram of Valium. But that doesn't mean he took them. I mean.
I don't know what happened, dude.
That's a lot. That's 100.
I tell you what, if he took that much, he wouldn't have been able to walk.
No.
He would have been dead.
He wouldn't have been making it to the.
No.
Yeah. And. So they did come. I wonder where the like medicine on the base normally came from, if it came from Pakistan, because that's where he said that the sergeant was getting his from.
Yeah. They brought it over in the to the bazaar from Pakistan to Afghanistan.
So I wonder if he was getting his from the sergeant, or
I'm
if
sure
it was planted or.
Oh, yeah, it could be.
Because why?
It was secured by Torres, so what do you think?
Yeah, and why did they find three more the next day?
I know. Who do you think could get a hold of 15 blister packs? The sergeant?
Yeah.
Like.
The military actually had suspected that someone at the base was providing soldiers with an ample supply of drugs.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah, and literally Matthew tells his mom that. So, later that year, Culp was told the CID formally named two unidentified soldiers as suspects in a drug operation that was at the base. Why won't they let... Well, I guess because they were just suspects. That's why they won't name them. Okay, never mind. So, after one of the soldiers invoked his right to legal counsel, however, the initiative was dropped. So, once he got a lawyer, they just dropped it?
They're like, never mind.
Never mind. Okay. So, the object would certainly have been bad for the Army. How are we saying that?
Asadabad.
I don't know. I was going to say like Asadabad, but I don't want to say that.
Badass.
Asadabad is a staging point for Pakistani narcotics flowing unchecked to U.S. troops throughout Afghanistan. Obviously, because...
Yeah. Shit.
Yeah. And on the base, Valium abuse was so widespread that for a few months after Matthew's death, Culp learned that all 120 soldiers in his battery were quietly pulled from their individual barracks and forced to sleep in open bays to deprive them of privacy for the remainder of their tour.
Because they were on drugs?
Yeah, I guess to keep them from taking the Valium.
So they could watch them?
Yeah. So...
I mean, you've got a huge problem right there.
Yeah.
You know, and if Matt was the drug runner and he would get these things, he was involved in a gigantic operation. If 120, you know, privates were made to sleep in the open after he died.
Yeah.
This was a huge operation.
Yeah. I wonder... That is correct. That's a lot of people too, yeah. So... Obviously, they would rather avoid like letting it out that people in the military are like doing these drugs. So that's why they were making them sleep outside instead of like prosecuting or trying to go after people.
Right.
So
it's just too big of a challenge.
Yeah. So. With Matthew's death, the existence of the drug ring would have provided a good motive to kill him.
Yeah.
Because he knew about it. And on the morning that Matthew's death, his condition in the gun tower could have landed him in the hospital where questions would have been raised and he might have begun to talk.
Yeah, he should have gone to the hospital. They should have taken him to the hospital.
Yeah, so the thing is he's wanting out of this, and is it suggesting that maybe he was wanting out so he took the Valium so maybe someone would send him somewhere?
Maybe. That happens.
Yeah, he could have been wanting to talk to somebody, and then...
What if he was like, I'm going to try to really get attention with this drug use so that... Because they won't believe me otherwise.
Yeah, but then Taurus found out that he was showing up that way.
Yeah.
When, you know, intervened.
He was like, well, I'm going to have to end this.
So, but none of this proves that Matthew was murdered. You know, I mean, it's a good motive and stuff, but they can't prove it.
Exactly.
So, the inner life of even those closest to us can be secret. And some people do commit suicide without warning, just leaving their families completely shocked.
Right.
And it does happen, but I feel like with him being open with his mom about the drug ring thing that had been going on, I feel like he probably would have showed some kind of sign to her. I mean.
Right.
Because that's being happy and... you know, saying that you might not come back alive because someone is going to kill you. And then 2 weeks later, you kill yourself.
Ugh,
that doesn't make any sense.
That's not right.
So, it is possible that Matthew took his own life, but it is also possible that everything Matthew told his mother about the drug ring, it is also possible that everything Matthew told his mother about the drug ring could be untrue, and that Torres and Jackson were guilty of nothing more than inadvertently violating standard crime scene protocols. So basically, we just, you know, we don't know if Matthew was killed.
Right.
But we can be certain how he died because the CID investigators seem barely to have considered any possibility other than suicide.
Even though they saw the drug problem.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't understand how any of that. How are these people, like, living with their
selves?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, they, you know, they still didn't care.
Yeah.
That all this drug use was going on. Why do they not care about the drug use of? I mean, I guess they care, but like...
They care more about that than the...
They care so much about it that they don't want it to get out because they don't want to look bad. They care more about how they look than about actual people. Okay.
Yeah.
So, their greatest concerns appear to be that Matthew's habitual drug use and the strange disappearance of his wallet...
Oh my God, you guys are just going to steal his wallet? That's low.
Yeah. And why are they so concerned about his drug use? It doesn't matter.
Like, it's his fault.
Yeah. And it was not found after careful searches of his quarters, or his wallet was not found after careful searches of his quarters and the tower, as well as two searches of his body. Yet, it mysteriously materialized inside the body bag after it arrived at Bagram. What?
So somebody put it in there, obviously.
Oh my gosh. So Jackson had accompanied Brown's corpse on the flight. The investigators questioned him but drew no larger conclusions and ultimately just shrugged it off. But later, when Senator Barbara Boxer inquired about the missing wallet, the Army told her, incorrectly, that the CID agents had found it as soon as they arrived.
Why do they lie? Why?
Because how else are you going to explain that a wallet?
You can't.
Like, how are you going to tell the senator that the wallet mysteriously... reappeared.
I hate this so bad.
I know, it's awful.
And that is actually the end of part one.
Yes.
Of this story. Wow. I'm furious.
Yeah.
I'm literally furious. I'm fuming. I wish we could finish this in two parts, but at this point it's already like 2 hours.
In one part. It will only be two parts.
You
said you wished we could do it and we could finish it in two parts.
Yeah. I wish we could finish it in one part. But it's like already just so long and like a lot.
Yeah. It's a lot to, comprehend and kind of like think about, really.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Let us know what you guys think, on Instagram. And we're just shook. Like, I'm speechless.
Yes. And if you have any other military cases you would like us to look into.
Please do.
Yeah, send them to us because I find this, like, so interesting because the military is tax funded. But
And nothing's really done about it.
Yeah.
It's really hard to fight.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be that hard because we, the American people... you know, pay our taxes and are helping fund it, we should be able to honestly have access to like these files about these cases and to not be so hard.
It should be public record.
Yeah.
Not so much for just anybody, but at least for the family.
Yeah. Definitely for the family.
You shouldn't have to try that hard to get any information you want. Mm-mm. I know that they don't want families to see certain, like, autopsy photos to protect the family. But at some point, you just have to give it up and just give it to them. It's their right.
Yeah. And I think they understand. And if they're wanting to see the autopsy photos.
Yeah.
They know what they're going to be looking at.
Right. I know. Ugh. Well, we will see you guys next week for part two.
Yes.
And we hope you enjoyed your extra time off, if you got time off for Memorial Day.
Yes.
And follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.
At Crime Cafe Pod.
And email us if you're into that.
At crimecafepod@yahoo.com. You can email us case suggestions or anything.
If you have case information or not, you know, like sensitive information, but if you know anything about certain people that we've covered, if you know them personally, if you're a family member, reach out to us.
Yes.
We'd love to include what you have to say in a podcast if you want to.
Yes.
But we'll let you guys hear us next time.
Bye.